This is by Karen L. Garst, November 27th, 2015. The Faithless Feminist, as she calls herself. It says, 10 reasons humans created religion. Number one, to make sense of their world. Humans are meaning-seeking beings. They want answers to questions. Why did the sky erupt in fire? Why did the sun go dark? Why did my newborn child die? And the list goes on. For many of these occurrences, early humans felt pure terror. Even we know what causes an earthquake today, it still causes fear and alarm for those affected. So how do we make sense of these events? Early humans created an explanation by positing the notion of some kind of a supernatural entity that was angry at them. Many of the early deities, not surprisingly, were sky gods. They lived, quote unquote, up there and rained down fire and calamities on the humans living below to appease these deities, to make them less angry. People developed practices such as animal and human sacrifices, as well as other rituals. As Robert Wright explains, humans tried, quote unquote, to raise the ratio of good to bad. As our knowledge of our world grew, primarily through science, we learned that events such as eclipses are predictable and that the universe is immeasurably fast. Vast, V-A-S-T. As this happened, the sky god moved from the physical sphere, S-P-A-G-R-E, to a more spiritual one. Unfortunately, some religions today have mired themselves so deeply in their stories that they have become oblivious to new discoveries in science, with some believing that the Earth was created in 4004 BCE because of the calculations of the 17th century Archbishop of Armagh Church of England, James Usher. 39% of Americans recently polled believe that the Earth was created less than 10,000 years ago. Now you're understanding more reason, the first reason why I don't practice religion. Science and religion contrast each other. Scholarship and theology contrast each other too. That's pretty much the first reason to why I don't practice any religion. Number two, to provide for a sense of belonging. Humans are not the only species on this planet that operate within social groups. They are also not the only ones that show empathy. Barbara King writes about the youngest son of Flo, an ape who was unable to cope with his mother's death. He stopped eating and died 3.5 weeks after his mother. The roots of our dependence on others go deep. Most scholars believe the word religion comes from the Latin word religare, which means to bind fast. F-A-S-T. While the word bind has both positive and negative connotations, it indicates something that holds people together. Modern religion has a myriad of activities that provide cohesion for a group. Stories that trace the history of a culture, rituals such as communion, music in many forms, and ceremonies that cover virtually every aspect of life from birth to death. The negative aspects of the word to bind also come to play with the practice of some religions, such as the fellowship in the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints, Mormon, which banishes members from their families and friends when they leave the church. See what I mean? So I'm detecting mythological attachments when it comes to sense of the world. And a false sense of belonging. That's This pretty much the second reason why I left religion. Number three, to seek help in their endeavors. Imagine a Paleolithic cave. It is a refuge from a harsh environment. Evidence of fires near the entrance show where the people lived, ate, and gave birth. Female figurines, often with pregnant bellies, are mostly found in this area. In the back of the cave, one finds the wall paintings of animals such as those as Lascaux in France. Some of these paintings show evidence of being painted over multiple times. This is the space for the hunters and the shaman. What can they do to ensure success in the hunt? Does the shaman lead them in incantations? Does he perform another type of ritual? Shamans have studied in existing cultures such as, you know, are the first religious quote-unquote experts. It is likely it existed in the Paleolithic era as well. As Robert Wright explains, shamans are a crucial first step in the emergence of organized religion. They move the group from a fluid amalgam of beliefs about a fluid amalgam of spirits and what religion came to be, a distinct body of belief and practice kept in shape by an authoritarian institution. The shamans gave the hunters hope that they would be successful. Given the fact that they, even today, we only notice when a good result comes from religious efforts such as prayer, forget all those times when it does not. It's not surprising that the hunters became reliant on the shamans. See what I mean? All these three reasons for the creation of religion are absolutely troubling to me. So it teaches over-reliance. That's what religion teaches. Number four, teenified diverse people. It is believed that hunter-gatherer groups were more or less egalitarian. As small groups, they were fairly homogeneous. When our hunter-gatherer ancestors developed agriculture, they became more sedentary. Instead of wandering small bands, these tribes coalesced into larger entities. Undoubtedly, there was great diversity among these tribes who may have had little contact with others. Religion, with all that comes with it, can unify a group. As an example, a people came to the Nile, they brought their individual tribal gods with them in the form of a mascot or tribal fetish. As the country unified these diverse groups, a more cohesive theology developed to worship Ra, the sun god, also became the symbolic father of the pharaoh. Unity also makes it easy to defend one's ground, which became a necessity once agriculture developed. It is always easy to fight, quote unquote, the other when your leader is telling you that they don't believe in your God. We see this today as ISIS attracts people from diverse nations to fight all who do not believe as they do. In some ways, nothing has changed. The religion's ways of going, approaching unity and diversity is basically modern colonialism and modern imperialism. So far, the reasons that humans are creating religion are actually fearful and frightening for me, because I don't see overwhelming scientific evidence backing these things. I don't see most scholars confirming that all these things are true. Number five, to instill order. Settling in villages requires some type of order. The larger the community, the greater the need for a set of codes or laws to not only guide behavior, but to provide punishment for those who refuse to obey. Religion helped provide that. The very first laws were discovered in Elba, modern-day Syria, and date from 2400 BCE. More well known in Hammurabi's 1792-50 BCE code, carved on a stone tablet and now in the Louvre in Paris, whose purpose is stated clearly from the beginning. Anuin Bel called by name me Hammurabi, the exalted prince who feared God, to bring about the rule of righteousness in the land, to destroy the wicked and the evildoers, so that the strong should not harm the weak, so that I should rule over the black headed people like Shamash, and enlighten the land to further the well-being of mankind. The Ten Commandments, which is found in two versions in the books of Exodus and Deuteronomy, and formed the base of Jewish law, came much later, around 1000 BCE. In Judaism, it was the Levites who served as priests in the temple. As priests, they served to enforce the rules and norms of the state. Temples were indeed the first state houses. All of those these were examples, of course, predate any notion of separation of church and state. You mean to instill cult order, to unify diverse people in the name of a cult, to seek help in their cult endeavors, cult help, for a cult sense of belonging to a cult. That's what cult provision is. To make a cultish sense of their cultish world. Now it's making more sense as to why I say that I'm non-religious. Number six, to create a compassionate practice. Neanderthal precursor to modern humans lived from 400,000 to about 40,000 years ago. A skeleton referred to as Shanader the First shows an individual that had clearly been disabled long before his death. Others must have cared for him in order for him to survive. This is probably the first evidence of a compassionate practice in a social group. Later on, virtually all civilizations adopted some form of the golden rule, including most religions. Native American spirituality says it this way: all things are relatives. What we do to everything we do to ourselves, all is really one. Jainism states in happiness and suffering and joy and grief, we should regard all creatures as we regard our own self. The Yoruba and ethnic people in Nigeria have one of my favorite traditions. One going to take a pointed stick to pinch a baby bird should first try it on himself to feel how it hurts. If we're going to live together, we need to be mindful of how we treat each other. Unfortunately, our history shows that this does not always apply to those outside our tribe or ethnic group or our nation. In fact, religion has means to engage in war, subordinate women, and condone slavery, and justify genocide in spite of the lofty precepts of the Golden Rule. To create a cultish compassion. The reason why I use the word cult a lot, because history of religion shows that they create and say, oh, this is how God feels, but there's no scientific evidence to show that's truly how God feels. You know, there's no scholarship evidence to prove this is how God feels. So until I have the evidence that God actually ordains these precepts, I have to say it's a cult. Because if you truly are what you say you are, overwhelming evidence should back up everything you say. Number seven, to create stories that tell the history of a culture and its people. The Egyptian pyramid texts are the first recorded stories that could be called the basis of a religion. They date from the 3rd millennium BCE, contain a creation myth and introduce one of their gods, Osiris. Another early text from the 2nd millennium BCE that many believe influenced the biblical writers is the Babylonian creation myth, Enuma Elish. It describes the victory of God Marduk over the goddess Tiamat. While scholars disagree on the date of its origin, it predates the Bible. The Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, is an amazing creation in and of itself, written, edited, and compiled over a several hundred year span. It contains not only a creation story, the description of a god, but the history of the people. It's truly remarkable that more than 2,500 years later, some Jews still follow the dictates of Leviticus, including dietary restrictions. One would think that the smaller elements in these stories would lead to the classification of mythology for all of them. However, when Edith Hamilton's book of mythology was taught in my high school class, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam were not included. I find it interesting that religious people so easily dismiss the beliefs of others as myths, but refuse to examine their own stories in that same light. See what I mean? These stories and histories tend to be mythological. I'm like, if y'all are truly having an infallible theology, then how come wise people who are on the internet, they easily debunk what your religious texts say? And why I get shocked when that happens? Why Christianize everybody, get along, sing a song, and be friends and hold hands? I'm hearing more of the cult I have a hard time with religion. And because honestly, religion has a history of brainwashing. Brainwashing also is mind control, menticide, coercive persuasion, thought control, thought reform, and forced re-education. It's a concept that the human mind can be altered or controlled by certain psychological techniques. Brainwashing is said to reduce its subject's ability to think critically or independently, to allow the introduction of new, unwanted thoughts and ideas to their minds, as well as to change their attitudes, values, and beliefs. Now you see why I call it a cult? In the modern English, cult is usually a pejorative term for a social group that is defined by its unusual religious, spiritual, philosophical beliefs and rituals, or its common interest in a particular personality, object, or goal. And of course, there's more. Number 8, to provide hope for life after this one. Neanderthal graves show the earliest evidence of intentionality. Shells are placed in the eye sockets. Red ochre is used to paint the bones, and objects undoubtedly belonging to the deceased are placed in the grave. Become aware of one's own morality was undoubtedly frightening. And the harshness of early humans' lives, the lure of an afterlife must have been overwhelming. Many religions posit some type of afterlife. Egyptians mummified their dead and filled the tombs of the rich with grave goods because they believed the physical body would be needed in the afterlife. Later on, religious views of the afterlife took on a more spiritual nature. Even later still, the notion of hell came into play. Both of these concepts allowed religious institutions to control their followers. But ask yourself, how did that work out for the Egyptians who now dissect their mummies? Do you really need the promise of an afterlife and the threat of hell to live a good life on Earth? Why is it that the least religious countries such as Norway and Sweden have the most generous social programs, while the Christian Republican candidates for president want to cut funding for Planned Parenthood that provides needed health services for poor women? Number 9, to explain evil. Human beings have always done evil things. From the earliest skeletons ever discovered, the examples of man-made injuries. Today, one only has to listen to the first 5 minutes of a newscast to hear the latest murder, rape, or other criminal act. While the Old Testament talks about Satan, he is an adversary directed by God. It's only the New Testament later Christian writings that Satan is developed into the personification of a supernatural evil being who tempts people. The presence of an evil entity in a book that talks about an all-powerful God is a bit hard to fathom. Why didn't God just do away with Satan? If he is an omniscient and all-powerful Certainly that would have been a choice. Christian apologists use the notion of free will to explain the presence of evil. However, there is no free will involved in being infected with the plague or a newborn baby that dies shortly after it is born. And number 10, lastly, to feel good. Valerie Tarico writes that worship practices, music, and religious architecture have been optimized over time to evoke right brain sensations of transcendence and euphoria. Standing in Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, I can attest to these sensations. The beauty of the rose window with all of its shimmering colors as the light filters through, the vibrations from the massive pipe organ popping out an old hymn. Imagine what it felt to the hungry poor masses as they entered this place of worship in the first 14th century shortly after it was completed. I will wager that virtually everyone raised in faith and attested Tarico's explanation. For my part, I can still sing from memory the Christian hymns I learned as a child. My brother was still alive. He, my sister, and I would break out to the hymn, God's Word is Our Great Heritage, which the youth choir sang as it marched triumphantly down the center aisle of Trinity Lutheran Church in Burrsmack, North Dakota. From the earth at all to the present day, we have tried to explain why we are here on this earth and what is our purpose. It is not surprising that religion helped us cope, but it's time to examine whether we would be better off letting go of this mythology and focusing on the great problems we and our planet face. I think the whole letting go thing works for me. We can't afford to brush off climate change with God has a plan or excuse tragedies with. There must be a purpose or they're in a better place in heaven. I feel that way. These words will just not move us forward to make the changes we need to make to improve the lives of those who suffer and to leave this planet in a better place for our children and grandchildren. Again, these words will just not move us forward to make the changes we need to make to improve the lives of those who suffer and to leave this planet in a better place for our children and grandchildren. Karen Gass holds a PhD from the University of Wisconsin. She has worked as a field representative for the Oregon Federation of Teachers and has served as an executive director of the Oregon State Bar. She's compiling a book of essays by women atheists. She blogs at faithisfeminist.com. So you pretty much know 10 of the many reasons why I'm a secular person. So here we go. Yes, life without religion can be meaningful. Meaning in life without religion can be found in the many familiar, meaning-conferring elements that aren't religious in nature. Our lives will end permanently someday. All that matters is what our lives are like while they last. By Ryan Stringer, contributor in March 8, 2016. Most people want to live meaningful lives. They want to live lives that are worthwhile and fulfilling. But what makes life fulfilling and worth living? What makes life meaningful? For some people, religion does, or at least it plays a significant role here. Other people like me can't find any meaning in religion because they can't believe it. Yeah, I don't believe in religion. So I do live a meaningful, worthwhile, and fulfilling life. I just live life non-religiously. And I don't find any meaning in religion because I don't believe that would be me. So how does this then mean that people like me can't have meaningful lives? Are our lives doomed to meaninglessness because they don't include religion? Not at all. That's my answer. My life is not doomed to meaningless because I don't include religion. So I say, hell no, not at all. Life without religion can be meaningful. For me, that's true. Indeed, it can be very meaningful. Again, for me, that's true. Meaning in life without religion can be found in the many familiar meaning conferring elements that are religious in nature, which I agree. These include friends, that's me. Family, well, chosen family for me. Romantic love, I feel that. pets. That used to be me, but I like animals. I just won't be a pet owner anymore. Good careers, I already have that. Personal projects, I got that. Learning, I do that. Teaching, I do that. Noble causes, I fight for. Helping others, I do. Striving for excellence is what I'm about. Notable achievements and experiences is what I possess. Hobbies and recreational activities, so on, are the things that I engage. There are many non-religious sources of meaning in life, and it's in virtue of such things that life without religion can be meaningful. Yes, I did. I do tend to seek out non-religious sources of meaning in my life, and that my life without religion, again, is meaningful. It's a virtue. Religion does have an knack for providing a sense of purpose in life. I agree. It's also worth noting that life without religion can have purpose. That's my life. We surely do need purpose in life in order to have a meaningful one. It's hard to imagine having a meaningful life without having a sense of purpose in it. And religion, of course, can provide such purpose for many people. Nevertheless, it would be a mistake to think that religion is needed for this purpose, so that is the only thing that could provide such hope. I agree. Religion does not provide that purpose for me. I want to stay on record. Again, religion doesn't have a monopoly on providing a sense of purpose in life, and again, I agree. Instead, we can give purpose to our own lives, which I do. Take care of our loved ones, I do that. Helping needy humans or non-human animals, I do that. Fighting for good causes, example, freedom and justice, I do that. Striving for moral excellence, I do that. Contributing to science, music, literature, art, or other areas of enduring human culture, I do that. Such things can provide the non-religious with a sense of purpose in life, I still do that. It's worth noting, too, that life without religion can be meaningful and purpose, even though it's not lived for the sake of getting into heaven, or some other desirable afterlife, which I agree with that. Trying to get into such an afterlife may indeed provide some hope with meaning and a sense of purpose in life. Ever try to secure one's own place in a desirable afterlife isn't necessary for having a sense of purpose in life, for having a meaningful life, which I strongly agree with, because life without religion can be rich, for me it is, and the non-religious sources of purpose and meaning in life already mentioned, I have all those down pat. Finally, it's worth noting that our lives needn't last forever or look significant in the grand scheme of things or to be meaningful. Truth, actually. That's the truth, actually. Even though our lives don't last forever and may look utterly insignificant in the grand scheme of things, they can still be meaningful by containing a healthy amount of the meaning-conferring elements outlined above. I concur with what Ryan is saying. Our lives will be permanent someday. They might seem insignificant in the grand scheme of things, but these things don't matter when it comes to having meaningful lives. I agree. All that matters is what our lives are like while they last. What matters is what we have, what we do, and how these things affect us. I super agree. I want to say this on record. So, this is what I'll say. And here's what I mean by cults. This is AndyNasseller.com, six sociological characteristics of cults, February 20th, 2011. I noted previously that even though cult should be defined from the logical point of view, we can nevertheless gain valuable insights into certain aspects of the cultic mentality from sociology. One, authoritarian leadership. Authoritarianism involves the acceptance of an authority figure who exercises excessive control on cult members. As prophet or founder, this leader's word is considered ultimate and final. Often, this authoritarianism involves legalistic submission to the rules and regulations of the group established by the cult leader, or as in the case of the Jehovah's Witnesses, submission to the Watchtower Society. Cult members are fully expected to submit even if they do not agree with the requirements. Unquestioning obedience is compulsory. One of the reasons why I left religion is because authoritarian leadership is too easy and way too prevalent to occur. Two, exclusivism. Cults often believe they alone have the truth. The cult views itself as the single means of salvation on earth to lead the group to endanger one's soul. Again, exclusivism is too easy and too prevalent within religion. Isolationism. The more extreme cults sometimes create fortified boundaries, often precipitating tragic endings. We have already mentioned tragedies in Waco and Jonestown. Some cults require members to renounce and break off associations with parents and siblings. Isolationism is too prevalent and too easy in the world of religion. Number four, opposition to independent thinking. Some cultic groups discourage members from thinking independently. The quote-unquote thinking, as it were, has already been done for them by the cult leadership. The proper response is merely to submit. Too easy, too prevalent in religion, that is. Number five, fear of being disfellowshipped and excommunicated. It's not uncommon in cults that people are urged to remain faithful to avoid being disfellowshipped or disbarred or excommunicated from the group. Again, the Jehovah's Witnesses are a prime example where a person could be disfellowshipped or disbarred or excommunicated merely for questioning a watchtower doctrine. Six, threats of satanic attack. Finally, some cults use fear and intimidation to keep members in line. Members may be told that something awful happens to them should they choose to leave the group. Others may be told that Satan will attack them and may even kill them, for they will have committed unpardonable sin. Such fear tactics are designed to induce submission. Even when people do muster enough courage to leave the group, they may endure psychological consequences and emotional baggage for years to come. Sadly, some Christian groups share these characteristics to some degree. And it hurts that I have to agree with that. These are more reasons why I left religion. It's, you know, even opposition to independent thinking, fear of being disfellowshipped, disbarred, or excommunicated, and threats of satanic attacks are too easy and too prevalent in the world of religion. There's something that happens in religion that they choose not to talk about. I'm going to be talking about psychopathy in the church workplace. In the church, there are people who engage in the public humiliation of others, high propensity of having temper tantrums and ridiculing work performance. In the church, there are people who do the malicious spreading of lies, intentionally deceitful. In the church, there are people who are remorseless and devoid of guilt. In the church, there are people who frequently lie to push one's own point. In the church, there are people who produce exaggerated bodily expressions, yawning, sneezing, etc., as a means of gaining attention. In the church, there are people who rapidly shift between emotions, used to manipulate people, or cause high anxiety. In the church, there are people who intentionally isolate persons from organizational resources. In the church, there are people who are quick to blame others for mistakes or for incomplete work, even though they are guilty. In the church, there are people who encourage co-workers to torment, alienate, harass, and slash or humiliate other peers. In the church, there are people who take credit for others' accomplishments. In the church, there are people who steal and slash or sabotage other persons' works. In the church, there are people who refuse to take responsibility for misjudgments and slash or errors. In the church, there are people who respond inappropriately to stimuli, such as with a high-pitched and forced laugh. In the church, there are people who threaten any perceived enemy with discipline and slash or job loss in order to taint employee file. In the church, there are people who set unrealistic and unachievable job expectations to set employees up for failure. I admit one more time. In the church, there are people who set unrealistic and unachievable job expectations to set employees up for failure. In the church, there are people who refuse or are reluctant to attend meetings with more than one person. In the church, there are people who refuse to provide adequate training and slash or instruction to single out victims. In the church, there are people who invade personal privacy of others. In the church, there are people who have multiple sexual encounters with other employees. In the church, there are people who develop new ideas without real follow-through. In the church, there are people who are very self-centered and extremely egotistical. Often conversation revolves around a great deal of self-importance. In the church, there are people who often, quote-unquote, borrow money and slash or other material objects without any intentions of giving it back. In the church, there are people who will do whatever it takes to close the deal, no regard for ethics or legality. Within the church, there are people who do predatory bullying. The bully just enjoys bullying and tormenting vulnerable people for the sake of it. In the church, there are people who do instrumental bullying. The bullying is for a purpose, helping the bully achieve their goals. In the church, there are people who use bullying as a tactic to humiliate subordinates. And some of those church people are corporate psychopaths. There are church people who often have issues with social functioning. You have church people who lack anger management skills, and they have a distorted sense of reality. Within the church, there are people who have team ethics and values that prevent detecting. In the church, you have people who do not correct bullying and mobbing in the church workplace. And they love to cause confusion and divide and rule. In the church, there is In the church, there are people who embody intrigue. Church psychopaths may use highly developed social skills and charm to obtain employment into an organization. At this stage, it could be difficult to spot anything indicative of psychopathic behavior as a new employee. The church psychopath might be perceived by people to be helpful and even benevolent. You have church people embody assessment. Church psychopaths categorize people according to personal usefulness, and people could be recognized as either a pawn who has some informal influence and will be easily manipulated, as a patron who has formal position and can be used by the church psychopath to protect against attacks. Number three, within you do have church people who embody manipulation. Church psychopaths try to create a scenario of psychopathic fiction where positive information about themselves and negative disinformation or gossip about others, where people's role as a part of a network of pawns or patrons could be utilized and could be groomed into accepting the church psychopath's agenda. Number four, you have church people who embody confrontation. The church psychopath can use techniques of character assassination to maintain their agenda, and people will be either discarded as a pawn or used as a patron. And five, you have church people embody ascension. The role of the subject as a patron, the church psychopath's quest for power will be discarded. And the church psychopath will take for themselves a position of power and prestige from anyone who once supported them. So within the church, there are people who do workplace bullying of employees. In the church, there are employees who lose their jobs. In the church, there are legal liabilities. In the church, there are shareholders who lose their investments. In the church, there are people with wasted employee time. Within the church, there are people with suboptimal employee performance. Within the church, there's increased workload. Within the church, there's difficult working conditions. Within the church, there are poor levels of job satisfaction. Within the church, there are lower perceived levels of corporate social responsibility. Within the church, there's raised staff turnover. Within the church, there's absenteeism. Within the church, there's heightened level of workplace conflict, arguments, yelling, rudeness, and divide and conquer. And within the church, there's counterproductive work behavior. And within the church, there is reduction in positive productivity and social responsibility. Within the church, there's increased bullying, conflict, stress, staff turnover, absenteeism. And within the church, there are people who use bullying as a tactic to scare, confuse, and disorient those who may be a threat to the activities of the church psychopath. Some of them, corporate psychopaths within the church. Obviously, not all churches are indicted in my statements, and not everyone in religion is indicted by my statements. I'm just saying this is happening way too much and way too easily. Definitely more. It says progressivechristianity.org, spiritual networking resources for an evolving faith. Leaving Church by Martin Keelan on February 26, 2022. So this is Martin's words. Of the past year, I've engaged in ongoing conversation with a 40-year-old clergy person struggling with institutional religion. Like many others, he's grown weary of church work. I have too. I've been struggling with institutional religion my entire life too. COVID certainly didn't help. I feel the same as well. However, he felt close to burnout even before the pandemic arrived. So did I. It wasn't just routine congregational pettiness, conflict, and criticism that troubled him. Well, that didn't trouble him, but congregational pettiness, conflict, and criticism it does trouble me, and it did when I was in that church world. I can put up with church crap, he told me. Crap means shit. He's basically saying he can put up with church shit. I can't put up with church shit at all. Then he says, but I can no longer tolerate the disconnect between Jesus and the institutional church. I feel the same way. They don't remotely resemble each other anymore. I concur. I'm not sure they ever did. I vouch for that. Several months ago, he resigned his church, left vocational ministry, and took a job as a social worker. To be honest, there are a lot of people leaving religion, leaving church, leaving Christianity, leaving ministry, leaving the pulpits, leaving the pews, leaving the choir loss, leaving church leadership, cutting ties with partnerships with other ministries, and changing professions. He also quit going to church and doubts he'll ever return. Honestly, for me, at this point, I don't see myself returning to physical church buildings. For right now, I just don't see it. He explained his life-altering decision by saying, I finally come to the sad conclusion that if I want to authentically follow Jesus, I have to leave organized religion. I've arrived at that sad conclusion for myself. I authentically follow the human rights Jesus, not the religious Jesus. And it says, get me out of here. He's not alone. Huge numbers of people, both lay and clergy, are, in the words of Barbara Brown Taylor's best-selling book, Leaving Church. Since she wrote that book 15 years ago, the trend of leaving church has rapidly accelerated, and I am a part of that trend. And like Barbara Brown Taylor, people still write about it. I'm still podcasting about it. A few recent examples follow. In Religious Refugees 2020, Quar, Mark Gregory Karras said, being in the church has been like staying in a long-term abusive relationship. That's an accurate description of my own relationship with the church. The problem is I love the woman so much. I feel that. At least I think it's love. Maybe it's infatuation. Perhaps it's Stockholm Syndrome. Those words deeply resonate with me. I'm not sure. Anyway, I stayed because I had the stubborn hope she would change. So did I. I dreamt of being the valiant hero who came along, swept her off her feet, and dramatically transformed her into the stunning princess she was meant to be. That's exactly what I envisioned when I was in church buildings. Unfortunately, nothing I did seemed to work. I second that. Over the years, things just seemed to get worse. That's a hard truth about my own life. Time after time, she, meaning the church, abused me. That happened to me too. She, meaning the church, verbally assaulted me. that happened to me too. She, meaning the church, tried to control me. That happened to me too. She, meaning the church, manipulated me. That happened to me too. She, meaning the church, gaslighted me. That happened to me too. She, meaning the church, stabbed me in the heart with a rusty and serrated knife. That happened to me as well. But like a lovesick idiot, I kept coming back. That was also my reality. I thought maybe tomorrow it would be different. Maybe tomorrow she'll, meaning the church, love me for who I am and all of my theological quirkiness. Those are my thoughts to the T. But she, meaning the church, didn't. That occurred to me too. And after some reflection, I finally came to the realization we needed a break, HLT. Maybe the break from church buildings may be permanent for me. The only churches I'm willing to attend are the Unitarian Universalist churches. I don't think I'll take a permanent break from them, but the other types of churches, I just might take a permanent break from them. In his best-selling book, If God Is Love, Don't Be a Jerk, YJK, 2021, well-known blogger John Pavlitz, who is a liberal progressive pastor, speaks openly about his disappointment and disillusionment with institutional religion in America, especially in the evangelical sector. I too am disappointed and disillusioned with institutional religion in America, especially in the evangelical sector, and I too am disappointed and disillusioned with institutional religion outside of America, especially in the evangelical sector. John Pavlovich says, I am sickened by this thing claiming to be Christianity. This monstrosity would be unrecognizable to him, meaning Jesus. Sadly, the American church and outside of the American church, other churches too, have in many ways become the greatest argument for someone not becoming a Christian, for rejecting organized religion, never looking back. Pages 136 to 137. For myself, I would say that I strongly agree with John Pavlovich with every word he said. In the introduction to her most recent book, Freeing Jesus Heart, 2021, Diana Butler Bass puts a provocative spin on the theme of leaving church. She tells about a religious experience she once had while looking at an image of Jesus at the Washington National Cathedral. As she knelt at the marble altar, prayed and gazed at a massive icon of Jesus, the one Christians call the Christ, she heard the voice of Jesus say to her, "Get me out of here." I imagine Jesus saying those words based upon my readings of the Bible and my experiences in institutional church. Diana's husband still laughs about that time Jesus actually to spring him from the slammer. So many people try to cage Jesus and put Jesus in a cell block. The Republican Party does it. It hurts for me to even say some people in the Democratic Party do that. And it hurts to even say that some moderates and centrists, whether Republican or Independent or Democrat, they do that to him too. Some people in the far left and many people on the far right imprisoned Jesus. Sadly, many independents put Jesus in solitary confinement. If space permitted, many additional examples could be given. Of course, these concerns certainly aren't few. Over 25 years ago, in leaving the fold, Prometheus Books, 1995, Austin Miles said, "I lost God in church." Two. Maybe by leaving the church, I'll get back to God. That's exactly how I feel. When Jesus ministered to individuals in the fields and in the homes, all went well. It was only when he got involved in the synagogues, the organized church, and tried to minister there that he got into trouble, page 272. That statement is biblically accurate. These harsh critiques of institutional religion are certainly not the whole picture. Plenty of churches genuinely attempt to live up to their ideals, and I appreciate them 100%. And they provide worship, purpose, meaning, hope, community, and concrete opportunities of service to large numbers of people. I highly adore that about them. Even with their flaws, many churches have done and continue to do a lot of good. It's important to remember that fact. I am so thankful for that. Clergy members must especially keep this in mind, or they won't survive this difficult chapter in American Christianity. And that's real. A long history of bad behavior. However, we cannot deny a stark and depressing reality. Legions of people, like me, are disgusted with the sorry state of institutional religion in 21st century America for many good reasons. For example, our country, North America, is currently struggling with massive challenges, including climate crisis, a coronavirus pandemic, monkeypox, poverty, hunger, racism, injustice, polarization, voter suppression. Heartless. Traitors staying in office even after they endanger the lives of children and adults. The gun violence epidemic. Broken homes, dysfunctional families, abuse everywhere. Sex crimes, violent crimes, murderous crimes, theft crimes, and serious threats to democracy. In response, what is the church doing? I love the question, and I love the statements. The Catholic Church continues to resist transparency and accountability in its massive pedophile priest scandal and cover-up, while focusing most of its attention on abortion. The Evangelical Church demonizes the LGBTQIA+, genderless, genderqueer, and non-binary community, fosters Christian nationalism, participates in partisan politics, and fights endless culture wars over things like mask wearing, vaccines mandates, critical race theory, the 1619 Project, the Second Amendment, transgender athletic competitions, and transgender bathroom laws. And the mainline church engages in constant ecclesiastical civil warfare over same-sex marriage, interracial marriage, women clergy, and gay clergy, carving up its already small and rapidly declining segment of the religious pie into even smaller pieces, completely disregarding Jesus' command to unite in love. Sadly, a review of 2,000 years of Christian history reveals that today's bad behavior in the church is not an anomaly, but the norm. Again, sadly, a review of 2,000 years of Christian history reveals that today's bad behavior in the church is not an anomaly, but the norm. In response to this never-ending nonsense, or should I say in response to this never-ending bullshit, a large and growing number of people are leaving church for good, including me. Who can blame them, or should I say could blame us, because that includes me. By and large, the church, past and present, fails to carry out its primary mission to love God and neighbor and advance what Christians call the kingdom of God. Instead, it engages in constant pettiness, fights, endless conflicts over secondary issues, consistently ignores the teachings of Jesus, the one Christians call the Christ, requires belief in outdated theological doctrines, and prioritizes institutional survival over following Jesus. Even the most faithful church members are wondering if it's worth it anymore, including a lot of clergy persons. For example, a recent Barner research survey in November 2021 revealed that an astonishing 51% of mainline pastors are seriously considering leaving full-time ministry. Here are my personal comments off the top of my head. Vipers go to church. Devils go to church. Foxes like King Herod in the Bible go to church. Whitewashed tombs go to church. Spiritually blind fools go to church. Spiritually blind guides go to church. Hypocrites go to church. Sharks go to church. The lions and the tigers go to church. The eagles who chew up worms in the nest for their bird babies, you know, the mother eagles, they go to church too. These are all metaphors for evil spirits within the church. A personal dilemma. This overwhelming dysfunction of organized religion presents a deep personal struggle for me. I'd say me too. I count that me too. I'm agreeing with Martin, the writer here. After 40 years of in the trenches ministry, I'm not currently active in a local congregation. I would say, technically, I joined the church at 5, even though I was never in a church. So I'm going to say, after 24 years of being in the Christian world, I, Antonio Ray Myers, am not currently active in a local congregation. After between 2002 through 2020, I was in church every Sunday except October and November and the last part of September 2014. That's when I was in college. And between the pandemic, I wasn't in a physical church. Last time I was at a worship service was February 27, 2022. Last time I was in a Bible study was March 8th. March 8th was the last time I was in a congregational meeting of some kind, which was Bible study. So after March 8th, I have not been in church in months. Let's keep going. So far, I've been able to blame my absence on the pandemic. That, you know, the pandemic made it easy for me. Well, should I say the pandemic made it easier for me to stop going to church. But that wasn't the biggest reason why I left. The biggest reason why I left was because the ableism, the racism, and the abuse apologists, rape apologists, history of church made me go, I'm the fuck up out of here. I'm the hell up out of here. Then it says, since my second retirement, in quotation of a year, since my quote unquote second retirement over a year ago, I've not been attending in-person worship services. That's what Martin says. For me, I say, ever since February 27, 2022, I've not been attending in-person worship services. Since March 8, 2022, I've not been attending in-person Bible studies. Those are some of the facts of my life. Then Martin says, I help provide care for my young, not yet eligible for vaccines, grandchildren on almost a daily basis. I commend him. In an effort to help keep them safe, I don't go to indoor public gatherings. I commend them for that. However, before long, my grandchildren will be vaccinated and I'll be able to go back to church. He says, however, before long, my grandchildren will be vaccinated and I'll be able to go back to church. I'm fully vaccinated. I'm not going back to in-person church anytime soon. Then it says, but the haunting truth is, I'm not sure I want to return to an institution that consistently untethers itself from the life, example, spirit, and teachings of Jesus. That's how the fuck I feel. I have no doubt that if Jesus returned today, he would barely recognize the institution that bears his name. I'd go a step further. I say, I have no doubt that if Jesus returned today, he would never recognize the institution that allegedly bears his name. That reminds me of a statement I heard from Dr. Opie Hendricks. He said, the politics of Jesus has been so perverted and distorted that surely if Jesus was alive today, surely he would stand against the very religion that bears his name. He would look at our religion and claim that it has nothing to do with him. Dr. Opie Hendricks is correct. Instead, I expect he would feel overwhelming heartbreak. I agree with Martin, the writer, on that. He would likely say, as he did to Diana Butler Bass, get me out of here. Oh, I have no doubt that his dissatisfaction would not be hidden whatsoever. This is an essential dilemma about how to relate to organized religion, certainly not unique to me. I'm on the same page as Martin. For example, I'm reading Martin's words. For example, I belong to a support group of retired mainline clergy persons. Of the six members in my group, only one of us currently attends church on a regular basis. If you do the math, that means 83% of us have left church, at least for the time being. Given our overwhelming disappointment with institutional religion, we don't know if we'll go back or not. I'm not going back. The church has been a hot mess for thousands of years. It's not changing anytime soon, so I'm not returning anytime soon. I, too, have overwhelmed disappointment with institutional religion. All of us grieve that reality, including me and Antonio Myers. On the other hand, we still hope that the church, at least smallpox, can make the radical changes to transform itself into something more Jesus-like. Those are my sentiments that I share with them. Although none of us are optimistic about that happening on a large scale, yeah. I don't have that optimism for that either. Martin says, a few weeks ago, I talked to an old friend about our uneasy relationship with the church. Uneasy relationship with the church is what I have as well. We've both been deeply blessed, deeply wounded by institutional religion. That's true for me. Although part of us wants to connect with the community of faith, I have that desire. We're not sure we want to carry that toxic baggage that inevitably comes with it. I don't want to carry the toxic baggage that inevitably comes with it. I was deeply blessed by institutional religion when it comes to the food, being able to use some of my gifts for good, and people acting nice, some people being nice to me. I was deeply wounded by institutional religion because of the cliquishness. Being a country club, the churches, being a social club, the churches, and conducting itself as a museum of the church is, and that's what deeply wounded me. We both feel deep affinity for Jesus and still seek to follow him. My heart says that. My heart proclaims that. It's me saying that. You know, I'm agreeing with Martin. We're definitely not post-Jesus. Yeah, I don't consider myself post-Jesus in terms of the human rights Jesus. I, Antonio Ray Myers, has a deep affinity for the human rights Jesus, and I still seek to follow the human rights Jesus. I'm definitely not post-human rights Jesus, to clarify. Then it says, however, to our great surprise and deep sadness, we're both considering the once unthinkable possibility of becoming post-church. It was an unthinkable possibility for me growing up. You told me that, I would have been horrified and started crying. But I am officially now post-church, and it hurts. During our long conversation, my friend shared a quote attributed to Alfred North Whitehead. The English mathematician and philosopher once said, "'Tis a great tragedy to linger in a land through which one has already passed." My friend and I wondered aloud if we already passed through the land of institutional religion. I know I did. Neither one of us is sure if we want to linger there much longer. I don't want to linger there much longer. Part of us wants to, well, the child in me does. But part of us doesn't. The adult me is just like, there has to be a better way to do church. For now, the question remains unresolved for the writer Martin. The question remains solved for me. And this is to be continued. Martin Thielen is the creator author of Doubters Perish. Doubters Perish, something that's something I can definitely.